The second line.
No, I better not. You could just push your luck so far, do you agree? And it is a fact that I have damn little luck, so I better not start pushing it. So stay tuned for the Culture Hour, gang. Once again, we delve into the life and times of... It slipped my mind. Speaking of culture, if I may bring that bad subject up here on a Friday, you know, with the weekend about to happen, already I can see the excitement growing out there on the Jersey Turnpike. We can see the Jersey Turnpike, you know, from the top of the building here. And you can just feel the pulsating passions of the Jersey natives out grazing on a Friday night. You know that there's more bars per capita in one Jersey city, New Jersey city, not Jersey City, but one Jersey town right across the riverfront, more bars per capita than any other city this side of the Mississippi. Did you know that? What town is it? You've been there? You haven't been there. Well, you know, they now charge admission to the town. You know that when you come in there. But that's, neither here nor there. Speaking of culture, speaking of talent, the other night I started on a show, which I did not finish. It was too painful. I must apologize to all of you out there who have written angry cards saying, when the hell are you going to finish the story? This was one story I could not finish. It was a story, do you remember, I referred glancingly to my experience driving heavy equipment. Yes, you call that? Well, you see, you weren't around at that time. You were out there standing knee-deep in the water off Chadwick Beach or someplace trying to see a wave. But I will tell you this, that the story that came out last week about this guy driving a tank through the PX, you read that story? The Army, the GI got bugged, and he drove his, he got a tank, about a 75-ton tank, and he drove it through the PX, and then he ran over the service club. He tried for one of the latrines, but they stopped him before he could get there. I don't know how they stopped him. Were they bazookas or what? It wouldn't be easy to stop a guy in a 75-ton tank if he was really concentrating. But, if I may get back to the subject here at hand, this is the first weekend, as far as I'm concerned, this is the first summer weekend. I don't care what the official summer day is. What is it, the 21st? 21st of June is the first day of summer. Or didn't you know that? The 22nd? The 7th? Did you think it was the 7th? Where the hell did you get that date? That's Pearl Harbor Day. I mean, you're confusing Arbor Day or something. No, the first day of actual summer is the 21st or the 22nd, right in that area. You know, it happens around 2 in the morning, something like that. But it's the 21st of June. And the first day of spring was officially March 21st or 22nd. So we're really officially in spring. I'm talking about officially. Now, as far as I'm concerned, you know, when the first weekend of June hits, that's it, man. And you can't fight it. I mean, you can just feel the pulse pick up in your veins. You realize, of course, you're an engineer. I'm not so sure that happens to engineers. But the ordinary walk among human beings, it does. The pulse picks up, and I can feel it. Sometimes I feel like my veins are just charged and filled with Dad's old-fashioned root beer, you know, which, since kids are up at this hour, I have to say. but it is the beginnings of June, and I'll never forget what happened to me. This, every time I get this heady feeling, because the idea of mobility, getting out and going, hits the human being like a tornado in the spring. You have that feeling that you want to go? It's built into the race. You know, there's a theory, and I'll throw this theory out to you. There is a theory, because we're part of the animal kingdom, you know. And there's two kinds, really, roughly categorized. There's many different categories in the animal world. But there's two types of animal, roughly categorized. And one is the nomadic animal, the animal that literally moves over its range and spends most of its lifetime in movement. And then there's the other, the sedentary or stationary animal, which when it's born, it lives and dies like within 20 feet of where it was born. You know, those are the two types of animals. Now, for example, the grizzly bear is definitely a moving animal. He will move over a great vast area. So is the elephant. They will clock them over hundreds of miles. The elephant is always moving. And there is a theory that man, in his very earliest inception, the very earliest, before he was even man, you know, before he invented all these great cultural things like the Merv Griffin show and all, you know, the stuff that really shows he's civilized. Before all this stuff happened, he was basically a nomadic creature. By instinct, he had to keep moving over his range to keep looking for food and to keep doing whatever it is he had to do to keep alive. And he moved. And he moved without any conscious will. He was moving by instinct. It's like the geese. The geese don't sit around, you know, and say, gee, you know, kind of nice to take a 2,000-mile trip. What do you say we all take a flight down to the Everglades? They do it by instinct. All of a sudden, the goose finds himself in the middle of the air with his wings flapping, and he's going. And he can't stop. Well, this is a theory about man, that at this time of the year, he gets an intense urge. This time of the year and in the fall, these those two times, he gets an intense urge to move, either to move back or forth. Now, in the fall, he gets an insane urge to move to the, in a sense, to the nest. He's almost like a hibernating animal, like the bear. So people go in the summertime, and have you noticed that immediately following, almost like somebody pulled a shade, it's eerie. If you go to places like Maine, I spent a lot of time in Maine. You go to Maine, and the summertime, you know, people come up to Maine. All kinds of people from all over the country come up to Maine. And it's beautiful. The weather is fantastic. And then all of a sudden, it's Labor Day. Labor Day hits, like say Labor Day is on a Monday, let's say for argument's sake, and there's a whole crowd of people. The next morning, the state is empty. You've seen that happen. It's fantastic. It's just like some kind of a switch has been pulled, and the entire state empties out. Just bam. Nobody there. Well, now, if you're smart and you want to go to Maine, the obvious thing to do is to go the 2 weeks or 3 weeks following Labor Day, which incidentally are the most beautiful parts of the year up there. But nobody's there. Absolutely nobody. I mean, you can shoot a shotgun right down the main street of most of those little coastal tourist towns and not even hit a postcard seller, you know? There's nothing. Well, this is the instinct to flee back. It's overwhelming. And so the whole crowd, just like a great vast herd of geese, they rise in the air and they start flapping the wings on their Pintos and their Chevy station wagons, and they flap all the way back to the Bronx, wherever they came from, you know. So the urge to go out is really, it's instinctive. And I actually was the victim of this instinctual behavior one time. And it involved heavy equipment. Now, that GI that drove that tank, I understand that problem. Now, to those of you who have never been close to heavy equipment, really close to it, will have no idea what I'm talking about. And I'm not even directing this at you. I'm talking about the curious magnetic pull that, say, a gigantic bulldozer has on you. You ever been next to really a big one? You can hear it pulsing, and boom, 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 boom. And you can feel the ground shake under that enormous 600-horsepower diesel engine. Boom, 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 boom. You feel the heat radiating from it. And way at the top is this leather seat. And it's this big, flat, black steering wheel with this great big knob sticking out of the dashboard up there. and you get this feeling, you know, I'd just like to get up there and sit in that seat once and just throw that baby in gear. Just drive it out. Well, most of us spend our lives as spectators. And I feel sorry for the spectators. To me, the world can be divided into two groups, the spectators and the doers. And if you're a spectator, you never understand how it feels to be a doer. If you're in the audience, you don't understand how it feels to be on the stage. And in fact, working a great deal on stages, I've never been able to explain to people what the feeling is, say, to stand before 2,000 people at Carnegie Hall all by yourself, and you're going to make them laugh when you're up there. They've come to make... To be amused, and you're up on the stage with the lights on you, and it's up to you to do it. Now, that is a feeling you cannot express to anybody else. No way. Even the fact that you were in the oral hygiene pageant in third grade is not at all the same. Not at all. When you see the lines of people out by the box office, and you see your name up on the lights, and you see the posters out there, and then you hear the music, and now it is 8:15, and you've got to get out there, you know. And the band starts playing.
Yes, sir. A lot of tune, and the crowd starts cheering out there.
Yeah, yeah. And there you are. You're standing down in the wing, you see. You've got this makeup all over you, and the lights are flashing off and on the stage, which means the stagehands are getting a little bit nervous. They want to see this damn show get going because they got a strong union. It's a hell of a lot stronger than yours. You better get out there now. The band's playing. And you go out there, you know, you start doing your shuffle. You lick a tick a turn, turn, turn. You take your straw hat and dip it. Yes, sir. That's my baby. That don't mean baby. Yes, sir. That's my baby now. Bop a doo doo doo. The crop. That's her.
That's a feeling.
Well, you kind of like that. At least set that in there. That was kind of good, you know.
Yes, sir, that's my baby. No, sir, don't mean maybe. Yes, sir, that's my baby now.
Well, anyway, I think that one of the great... I'm not pro-army. I'm not pro-war. I must hasten to tell you this. But one of the great byproducts, and it is a great one, and I'm not saying a good one or a bad one, a great one, a large one. I'm using it in that sense. Byproducts of having been in any of the armed services is most guys are suddenly forced to become doers rather than audience. and that, to a guy who's a natural audience type, this is an unconscionable problem. You know, he's not used to having to do things. But you do in the Army, or the Navy, or the Marine Corps, or whatever you are in. And you do things you would never have the opportunity to ever possibly do. For example, not many guys have ever had actual instruction, very detailed and technical instruction on how to, say, fire a heavy caliber long-range rifle to best effect. Either of you? Have you ever had actual qualified technical instruction, long practice on a rifle range, on how to really do it? Most people just, you know, they learn how to... their father shows them how to fire a gun or something. This is another story. I'm talking about technically done. So that, you know, you can lay out of 10 shots, you can lay 7 of them right in the middle, right in the bull, you know, at 300 yards, which is shooting. Now, that's what you have to do. Now, another thing, too, can you honestly say that you had instructions on, say, how to fire a 50 caliber flexible machine gun, which fires a slug that weighs about a pound and a half? Whew. I mean, when you're behind that baby and you start to operate those, they have squeeze triggers on that thing, and you start firing it, and you see those tracers going way out to sea. And way out there at the end of those tracers, there's a boat that's towing a target 4 miles out to sea. And you're putting it out right in those ring sight. Gun, 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 gun. You see those tracers. Whoo! Now, you're no longer watching a movie. Now, that's all different, see. So one day, did you know that the Army has its own, and I'm talking about all the armed forces, has its own driver's licenses? Did you know this? Uh-huh. Now you're going to learn something. You do not just walk up and drive a Jeep, show them your driver's license from Queens. No way. No, I'm serious. When you go into the armed forces and you're going to drive any type of equipment that is around, and you see in the movie, you see tanks, you see all this kind of stuff, you have to have a GI-issued certificate which proves conclusively, and you've been tested, that you can, in fact, operate this and are qualified to operate and are legally entitled to operate it if the condition arises. You don't just jump into a tank and start driving it. No way. Now, what do you think a GI driver's license looks like? Well, you don't just get a driver's license. I must explain something to you about that. In other words, if you get a driver's license, a civilian driver's license, it doesn't say on it what kind of car you can drive, does it? It just says operator, motor vehicle operator, period. Now, that means you can drive anything from a Mack truck. You shouldn't, but you can. If you drive it for your own car, you could. I mean, yes, you could. Yeah, if you run a Mack truck that was your own private vehicle and you went to the store with it, didn't use it for commercial purposes, you could drive it. Did you know that? Well, I'm telling you that, and you can drive a motorcycle, you can drive almost anything, merely because it says motor vehicle operator. Now, in some states, they've said, no, you have to take a special license for a driver to drive a motorcycle. But that's only recent. Now, nobody's going to say to you, well, since you learned how to drive in a Pinto, which is a small car, or a Volkswagen, that you can't drive a 400-horsepower Corvette. Now, you agree, they're very different types of vehicles. You realize that driver's license gives you the right, theoretically, to drive, say, a Maserati, which is basically a European race car, capable of 175 mile an hour speeds, and you may have never driven anything more potent than a VW, but you could get right in that Maserati and legally turn it on and start driving. Now, today, this is really a fantastic risk that a lot of people take. However, in the Army, they don't do this. So you get a driver's license. There's a folder, and it folds. And it's big enough. It's almost the same size. Well, it really is the same size as your driver's license, except that it has two sheets, and it folds, and it's blue. At least they were blue when I got mine. And I'm messing around the company area one day, which is wrong. You should never do this. And I'm just messing around, you know, fat, dumb, and happy, walking in and out of the day room, when a head pops out of the orderly room, which is the main office of a company. Head pops out. And it's this sergeant. He says, hey, come here, you. Come on over here. Yeah, I mean you, the PFC. Come on. Well, there I am, see. So you don't say, well, I'm on my way to my guitar lesson or something like that. You do. You come. So I turn around. I come into the office there. And there's the sergeant. And he's sitting at a typewriter. And he says, give me a name. I says, Shepard, J.P., 1609894. What the hell is he typing? He's typing away, see? He said, how long you been in grade? I said, what do you mean? How long have I been a PFC? He said, don't get smart with me. How long you been in grade? I say, 17 months. This is a sore point with me. 17 months already a PFC, a little bug, you know? So he says, what company in? I said, what company? Oh, yeah, I'm this company. Oh, he says, that's good. All right, company can't get you. And he says, he rips this thing out, and he goes into the next office, which, by the way, is where the CO was. And he's in there for about 8.5 milliseconds, and he comes back out. And now he's got this thing he's been typing, and it's signed by the CO. And he hands it to me. He says, here's your GI driver's license. I want you to get on a motor pool. So I want you to get qualified the following vehicles. I've got them typed up here. You take them down, give them to the sergeant of the motor pool, and you will get qualified in them vehicles. I expect you back here by 15:30. Once you see back here by 15:30, I'm going to call the motor pool, and don't you try goofing off because they is expecting you, right? All right, now on your way, buddy. What the hell? You know, out in the street I go, and I look at this blue thing, and it says GI driver's license, you know, and there it was. I'd never gotten one of these before, and I got to go down to the motor vehicle, and in a sealed envelope was the list of vehicles I was to be put through the paces on. See, I could drive. I think, what the hell, it's going to be great. So down the street I go, I go all the way down, I turn right, and I go about 19 blocks down through the camp, and there's the motor pool. Well, now, the motor pool is a great big... What it is a great big lot filled with this fantastic array of incredible stuff. And about 19 very tough guys who were at the motor pool. Toughest guys in the Army, motor pool guys. And I go up to the gate there, and there's a MP there. They don't let you in this place, you know. It's very highly guarded, so I walk up to the gate there, and he says, you got any business here, buddy? And I says, I do. I'm to see Sergeant, and I'll tell you the name. I'll invent the name to protect the innocent. Sergeant Schultz, right? I said, I'm here to see Schultz. He says, all right, hold on a minute. What did you say your name was? And I said, Shepherd J.P., 160-1609-8946 PFC. And he says, all right. He goes into the little gate, makes a phone call. He comes back out. He says, all right, go on right out past. He says, he's past them 2.5 tonners right down there. Turn right, and you'll see his shack. So here are these trucks all parked. Well, I get down to the little shack, and sitting in there is Schultz. And he's surrounded by clipboards and cans of grease. And he, you know, he looks like a mechanic, you know, and he's got an old pair of battered fatigues on with stripes. He's a buck sergeant. I walk in, and Schultz says, well, let me take a look at the list. Yeah. See, we got you here for a Jeep, 2.5 tonner, 1.5 ton troop carrier. And by God, a half track. He says, I got you down here for a half track. He says, what the hell are they going to use a half track down at Company K for? I said, look, Sergeant, I don't make up the list. Sergeant, please. So at that point he says, wait a minute, I'm gonna check. So he picks up the phone and he calls Kowalski back at the company. And he says, hey Kowalski, I got a guy down here that says he's supposed to learn how to drive a half track. And hear the blah, 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 blah on the phone. He said, well, what are you guys going to use a half track at Company K for? What do you need a half track for? So, well, look, I'm not going to argue with you. I'll take him out. I'll qualify him on a half track. But if anything happens, don't come back and complain to me, right? Okay. I'll see you, Butch. He hangs up. He said, well, we might as well start with a half track. So we go out. I'm talking about the motor pool, Jimmy, how I got qualified in the half track. So we walk out of the shack. And he says, come on down to the half track yard. So we walk on down, we turn right, we pass all the Jeeps, we go past all the pail trucks and all the 2.5 tonners and all the troop carriers and 1.5 wheelers. And I couldn't. Here's the half track. Their demonstration half track. Now, for those of you who don't know, you've seen a half track, Jimmy? For those of you who do not know a half track, if I drove a half track down 6th Avenue, I would sink in up to the hubs just from the weight. It is a monster. It's a half 45-ton truck attached to the front end of what looks like a tank. It's a tank in the back. You've seen half tank. This thing is a monster. So I immediately started to get excited. See, I'm going to learn how to drive this thing. So Zari says, I'm going to get up this in the operator's. They don't call it the driver's seat and get a thing like that. He says, I'm going to get up in the operator's slot. You go on the other side. He says, and watch what I do, and you got to be careful. You got a driver's license, kid. And I said, yeah, I do. I drive. He says, all right, let's go. And we got up to the top of this thing, and I look out, and I'm looking down from about a five-story building. I can see the tops of the giant truck. I'm looking right down at him. Yeah. So he says, all right, here we go. So he's bought 9 different switches. He throws on the panel of this thing. It's got all these flat black meters all over it. And it goes. I said, oh, my God, listen to the siren. He said, don't get excited. That's just the starter. He said, that's just the starter motor. And then boom, it started. I mean, that wood stretched out in front of me about the length of a 100-yard football field. And you could see it had big pipes, big diesel pipes coming out of either side of it. You know those big mufflers, Jimmy, sticking out on either side of it? With those big exhaust pipes. It's jiggling. I see the flint. The whole horizon is jiggling around me. He says, all right, you got your strap on, buddy? I said, yeah! He's right! Here we go! Gum, 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 gum. He shifted, and we start to move over the ground. And you hear the big track, big clanking track behind me going. We're running
and over both of us. And now we're heading for a big open vacant field. It's nothing but gravel. He says, all right, this thing will spin in its own place. He says, watch this. You operate the various, each one of them tracks back there operate separately. Do you hear me? It ain't like driving a car. I pull the left lever and the left track stops. I pull the right lever, the right one stops, push it forward and it goes. That's how you turn. Here we go. We spin around. I see the clouds going around me. Well, 5 minutes later, he says, get in the seat. Your turn. And I strapped myself in, and I grabbed those levers, and I started to move those things back and forth. I moved them back and forth, and I started to feel the power of this fantastic machine running through my very veins, through my nerve endings. And under that beautiful June sun, I drove a half track for 2 hours. Up and down, doing figure eights, back and forth, running up and down survival courses. Up, these things will go straight up a brick wall and straight down a cliff. And after it was all over, he says, you know, you're pretty good, kid. Not bad. He says, the 2.5-tonner, that'll be nothing after this. You know, you're not bad. You should have gone to the armory. I said, oh, boy. And he wrote on my GI license, qualified to operate under any and all conditions, a 37-ton half track. Went right in there, signed his name, and I went back to the company, and from that minute on, I used to sit in the barracks, you know, and talk about the days when I was driving all that armored equipment. You know, I had that smile on my face of a man who looked into it. He's really looked into the vortex of hell itself, and he knows what it's about. He's been right there. So some days when I get out on the Jersey Turnpike and I see that traffic lined up ahead of me and there's a big traffic jam, I just feel the itch to get behind the levers of one of these big half tracks and just flatten all the traffic from here to Trenton. So just put it in gear and just sit up there, way up on top, look down over the Jersey, the